He finally came to a door marked stairwell.
"In for a penny, in for a pound," he muttered.
He slipped inside and climbed two stories before coming to another door. He eased it open a crack, pressing his eye to the narrow slit. He saw a wedge of what looked like a garage. The metal trestle roof lofted 20 feet or more, and there was a ramp that led to a pair of industrial-sized garage doors. Embedded in the rock walls next to them were thick steel blast doors that could be swung closed. They looked impregnable to nothing less than a nuclear bomb. Max heard a radio playing some music that, to him, sounded like cats fighting in a burlap bag, but was doubtlessly something Mark Murphy had on his iPod. He saw nobody, so he quickly dashed through the door and found shelter under a wooden workbench littered with greasy tools. Although the garage was dimly lit, there was a pool of light on the far side where a four-wheel drive pickup sat. There were other vehicles parked in the garage. He spotted two larger trucks and several four-wheel ATVs. Moving cautiously, Max realized the garage doors were the only exit, the only one avenue open to him. Taking a pair of wire cutters from the workbench, he moved to the two trucks and opened the hoods, cutting the wires that sprouted from the distributor caps like black tentacles. As he started for the quad bikes, he saw a coffee machine set up on a workbench. Apart from filters, mugs, and a plastic container of creamer powder, there was a box of sugar. Max grabbed it, and rather than waste time messing with the ATV's electronics, he unscrewed their fuel caps and dumped sugar into their tanks. They wouldn't run for more than a quarter mile, and it would take hours to clean out their fuel lines and cylinders. A minute later, he was astride the one four-wheeler he hadn't tampered with and pressed the button that opened the garage door. It was night, and wind-ripped rain lashed through the opening. Max couldn't have asked for better conditions. There was no point closing the door. Kovac would know he was gone and how he was making his escape. Slitting his eyes against the rain, he twisted the throttle and shot out into the unknown. Amid the tumult of crashing cement, Juan fell through the hole Link had created, landing solidly on his feet on a flight of steep stairs. The air was an impenetrable wall of dust, forcing Cabrillo to run blindly down the steps, trusting that Link had cleared out of the way. A piece of cement the size of his head hit his shoulder with a glancing blow, but it was enough to throw him off his feet. He tumbled the last few steps and lay dazed on the landing, as more debris rained down all around him. A powerful hand groped for the back of his bush shirt and drew him into an antechamber and out of what was becoming an avalanche.
"Thanks," Juan panted as Link helped him to his feet.
The darkness inside the chamber was absolute. Link pulled a flashlight from his haversack. The beam was as bright as a car's xenon headlamp, but all it revealed were clouds of concrete dust.
"All right," Link began. "What's up your sleeve?"
Juan took the light from Link's hand and played it along the downward-sloping tunnel that had been bored into the earth decades ago.
"We see where this leads."
With a broad sweep of his arm, Juan indicated they should proceed down the subterranean passageway. One wall of the tunnel was a long, continuous slab of stone, while the other showed signs that it had been worked by tools. The two men could walk comfortably side by side, and there was at least 10 feet of headroom.
"This is a natural fissure the Japanese expanded during their occupation," Cabrillo said as he studied the rock.
"Most likely split open by an earthquake," Link agreed. "They built their factory, or whatever the hell it was, where the hole reached the surface."
Juan pointed out dark splatters on the stone floor. The spray pattern indicated it was blood, copious amounts of blood.
"Gunshot.
More than one victim, too."
Juan jerked the light away from the grisly tableau. His mouth was a thin, grim line. The air temperature dropped, and the humidity built as they descended deeper into the earth. It was thinking about the misery that had occurred here, rather than the plummeting temperature, that made Cabrillo shiver. The tunnel wasn't straight, but rather corkscrewed and twisted as it fell away at a gentle angle. After 25 minutes and more than 2 miles, the cave floor leveled out, and they discovered the first side chamber. The entrance was partially blocked by a minor cave-in, and the tunnel ceiling was a fractured mess of stone ready to collapse at any moment. This cavern, too, had been a natural geologic feature that the Japanese had expanded. The room was roughly circular, 50 feet across, with a ceiling that was at least 15 feet high. There was nothing in the cavern except some bolts along the walls that had once carried electrical wiring.
"Administration area?" Link wondered aloud.
"Makes sense, being the closest room to the surface,"